Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 39, section 5, which is old single column page 436. All right, so here we are again. We're slowly stepping our way through this this very methodical paper that they've laid out, where they give us one group of angels at a time, one after another, with all their each of the seven subgroups of each. So remember how we've been working our way down. We're now finally to those angels that are very directly involved with the actual mortal world level of the whole hierarchy. As we saw going through the other angels, there's a lot of those, you know, quote-unquote higher level angels that are still working all the way down to planetary level. But as you can see, the name planetary helpers are obviously very definitively now down to the planetary level. And you'll see that as we go into these subgroups, you don't have quite as definitive a recognizable pattern that ties to the previous one, you know, the previous subgroups. Because, as we've pointed out, we have to remember that there's no way we can appreciate what these angels are doing in a direct enough way to expect to, you know, for the pattern to just be very trivially expressible and recognizable by us with what limited, you know, description they can give us. You know, and so in a sense, when you can't see the obvious, it challenges you to try to reflect on some subtler connection that maybe you can kind of feel or begin to look for, you know, or maybe not even that much, maybe just desire for, you know, look forward to in the future being able to discover. You know, it may be something we can't fully appreciate now, even with the fifth epical revelation. Nonetheless, you'll see some, you definitely have the same sevenfold pattern, because some things are still overt in the pattern that we've seen. All right, so let's just jump into it, and we'll see that we begin to get some issues that hit pretty close to home for us, things that we know something about even without the fifth epical revelation.
Section 5, Planetary Helpers. These seraphim maintain headquarters on the system capitals, and though closely associated with the resident Adamic citizens, are primarily assigned to the service of the planetary atoms, the biologic or physical uplifters of the material races on the evolutionary worlds. The ministering work of angels becomes of increasing interest as it nears the inhabited worlds, as it nears the actual problems faced by the men and women of time who are preparing themselves for the attempt to attain the goal of eternity.
Okay, so just the one thing that you can see there to stress again, we have a lot of bias for where we are right now and thinking of it very definitively as a level in the hierarchy of the cosmos. And it is, yes, but not fully. You notice even with the quote-unquote planetary helpers, these seraphim maintain headquarters on the system capitals. Now, it is very much the case that that all of the inhabited worlds of a system are part of that system, you know, as opposed to something that's really below the system level. You know, they really are part of the system level. You have just three levels in the local universe: the local universe headquarters level, the constellation level, and the local system level. Okay. It's just when you're down in the local system level, you know, is the emphasis at the top with the headquarters of the local system, or is it down in the trenches, you know, of the actual mortal inhabited worlds? Okay, so you can see that, and so that's why they say it that way. So it's really, we're at the local system level still, as we were with the previous one. It's just now the emphasis are primarily assigned to the service of the planetary atoms. And the means of them being definitively related to the local system headquarters and yet still really made for the planetary worlds, the actual immortal worlds, it is the material sons and daughters, because they're both in both locations. They're both at the local system headquarters and down there in the trenches. See, so they're pointing out that it's just that very naturally they're going to be sort of parallel. These angels are parallel with the ministry both on high and down below of the material sons and daughters, you know, which are called planetary Adams and Eves when they're down on the worlds. Okay, so that's all pretty straightforward. Let's see what else we have here.
On Urantia, the majority of the planetary helpers were removed upon the collapse of the Adamic regime, and the seraphic supervision of your world devolved to a greater extent upon the administrators, the transition ministers, and the guardians of destiny. But these seraphic aides of your defaulting material sons still serve Urantia in the following groups.
Okay, see, so again, how closely they are related to the material sons and daughters. Remember, we mentioned the planetary helpers last time, that since they were assigned, long after the rebellion on the world, yeah? Is there a question? Okay, let me just finish that statement and then I'll get to that. Since they were assigned, long after the actual, Caligasta rebellion on this world, in our case, for instance, you didn't have any rebel planetary helpers. So that issue wasn't in play. But when the Adamic regime, ends in default, most of them are taken away because they're just really meant to serve the Adamic regime, not so much whatever regime there is on the planet. But the extent to which the regime we have right now with the resident governor general is Adamic regime-like, they are here serving. Administrator angels that we read about last time, the extent to which the resident governor general administration is planetary prince-like is the extent to which they're still functioning. It reminds you of the complexity of the current planetary government, in that there's these different facets to it, and you have these distinct groups of angels working with one facet or another of that multifaceted planetary government. Yeah, so what's the question there?
What is the ministering work of angels not near the inhabited world?
Well, that's what we've been, if you haven't been on the broadcasts here recently, you go back and look at the previous groups of angels, starting all the way at the highest levels of activity in the local universe we've been reading about in these previous groups, all the way down. When you look through that, you'll get basically, I suspect, the answer to the question you're looking for. How is it related to us, either as mortals or as ascenders in the local universe? But in all these, including these planetary helpers, there are countless things that these planetary helpers are doing that don't have anything immediately to do with us. And in general, that's not even talked about, primarily because we couldn't understand it. So we just don't understand anything about the literalness of spirit energy systems and what's going on with them and stuff. you know, or not to mention all of the other personality activities and what have you going on our world and things that they just don't talk about. So yeah, that's, you know, you can answer most of that yourself by going back and doing a little study. All right, let's see. Speaking of those other groups of angels, you know, so remember we mentioned this, that when we were talking about the administrator seraphim, we kind of jumped over the planetary helpers and talked about a relatedness to the transition ministers. You see they're doing it here again, that, you know, and it's simply because these angels are so tied to the Adamic regime, whereas the administrator seraphim and the transition ministers are tied to the other things going on separate from the Adamic regime. So that's why they keep getting lumped together like this. And then they mentioned it's not a separate group like these seven groups we're going through, but remember there is another effective group always on a world, the guardian angels, you know, and if they're working with a human that's, you know, advanced to some degree, they're actual guardians of destiny like they mentioned here. But those, as we'll get to in a little bit in this paper, are drawn from all these different groups, and we've mentioned that a couple times. Right, so it's without, you know, a significant ministry of the planetary helpers, as they say, it devolved to a greater extent upon all those others that are more the kind of more generalized, maybe you'd say, angels, whereas these just have this kind of hyper specificity to the ministry of the material sons and daughters. All right, and now before we go into that first group, as you glance down at that, if anyone who's familiar with the book of Genesis and in the Bible, in the Old Testament, you know, have some memory of this little story about what goes on in the so-called Garden of Eden there with Adam and Eve. And, you know, you may remember when, you know, as that story goes, when they do what they're not supposed to do, there's a voice in the garden. Now, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, that quote-unquote voice in the garden, you know, and, you know, sort of the, you know, like if you look at, say, the King James, you know, it'll have those exact words in the story. But notice here, it's not voice, they didn't just take that directly out of the Bible and use it. They tweaked the preposition. The voices of the garden. Okay? So the idea there is, yes, if you reflect on that, that separate from the way humans happen to have told stories, you know, about things that we hardly remember anymore, but are only there kind of mythologically, there are always this group of angels that are very definitively attached to the garden as the headquarters, and they, you know, they sort of personify the integrity that is the garden, separate from Adam and Eve. And so, you know, remember, if you read the Adam and Eve story in the fifth epistle of Revelation, there is a parallel where Adam and Eve, the actual Adam and Eve, not the mythological one, you know, go astray, and there's an angel that says, okay, let's sit down and have a talk, okay? That voice of the integrity of the garden, see, is there. See, so that aspect, that there is a voice that speaks of the integrity of the garden separate from Adam and Eve, that got maintained through 40,000 years almost, see, of oral tradition, you know, and then finally written down. You know, and is basically there. That truth is in the story in the Bible still. You know?
Attributed to God in the Bible.
Right, sure. You know, it's the voice of God in the garden. Okay. And of course, it's being, you know, that story is being redone by the priests in the exile, so they make sure that they add, you know, the word Yahweh to the story, you know, and so it's, you know, You know, if you look in your Bible, you'll see it says Lord God with Lord in all caps, because that's the word Yahweh that's, you know, that's there too. And right. But nonetheless, you know, that idea, see that the separate from Adam and Eve, there is this the garden represents this seat of integrity of heaven, quote unquote, you know, effectively brought down to earth, you know, and present there as a sign for all of the, you know, very primitive humanity still, that this is what you need to be challenging yourself to strive for. This little measure of integrity that's been brought into the midst of the primitive chaos of your world. And so these seraphim, see, are the voice of that garden, the integrity of that garden. And okay, remember the first subcategory we've been going through. It's always been, you know, the angels that are ministering to the sons, that, you know, the executive action, the administrative action. See, so you can see it still here. This first category is that definitive executive administrative, you know, group again. So that this one is still recognizable as fitting in the subcategory. All right, so what do we have with it? Oh, yep.
Chris, do you think Moses knew the truth of that story of the voice in the garden? Actually, he's the one that's credited with penning it, isn't he?
Well, yeah, right. Yeah, I mean,
the
so-called books of Moses, yes, yeah. Right.
Is that what he brought down from
I guess, I can't remember if the revelators say something in passing. I mean, I doubt it. I don't recall them indicating Moses having a lot of sort of transcendent recognition of the actual history.
Right. It was more politically.
You know, if you wanted to suspect someone that may have known about some of those things, you know, it's Daniel.
When they
give you that very interesting little passing statement, Daniel fully understood these things. Fully understood is the word, you know, the expression. And, you know, that's why it's so suspicious that he probably, you know, was a cosmic reservist and actually had some, you know, was interacting directly with the planetary government and, you know, the Melchizedeks and whatnot at the time, and, you know, and knew of some things, you know, and may have been clued in on some of the actual history and stuff. You know, otherwise, how would he, you know, be so clear on all the different levels of God and all that that they're referring to in that passage?
I was thinking of being able to differentiate between what is more likely to be, in other words, that there's a hierarchy and there's levels, you know. Mm-hmm. How many was Moses' recognition?
Yeah.
He recognized those levels. Yeah. Of God,
you know? I don't know. I mean, you know, like they point out, a number of people throughout history, you know, even got visions that gave him some sense of seven levels that were at least the seven mansion worlds, or if not all the way to paradise in some, you know, higher level vision. Whether or not Moses had something like that, I guess I don't know. I don't know.
Muhammad seemed to have picked up something.
Right. See, you know, they point out there's a number of people that, you know, got little glimpses of things. All right.
One, the voices of the garden. When the planetary course of human evolution is attaining its highest biologic level, there always appear the material sons and daughters, the Adams and Eves, to augment the further evolution of the races by an actual contribution of their superior life plasm. The planetary headquarters of such an Adam and Eve is usually denominated the Garden of Eden, and their personal seraphim are often known as the voices of the garden. These seraphim are of invaluable service to the planetary atoms in all their projects for the physical and intellectual upstepping of the evolutionary races. After the Adamic default on Urantia, some of these seraphim were left on the planet and were assigned to Adam's successors in authority.
Okay, several little things there let's bring out. And a good example of, you know, make sure you're not thinking in simplistic literal terms when you're trying to understand what they're telling you in the Revelation. When they say, for instance, that this planetary headquarters is usually denominated the Garden of Eden, you don't think simplistically about that. Think truthfully about that. You know, go beyond the immediacy. It's not like, it certainly isn't like on every world they force people to learn it in English, you know, to say Garden of Eden, you know, okay, so it's obviously not that. But it's not just, you know, saying those same words in some language on that other world. The point is that whatever it's, denominated, see, as they indicate there, it's denominated in a way that there's a reference to Edentia, right? I mean, you know, we've got this sort of chicken and the egg thing going on, you know, with the word Eden, you know, where they're using it to name the constellation headquarters, you know, Edentia, you know, the Edenic place. Why? You know, you guys probably remember, because on the constellation headquarters, you've got that massive whole hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, that's all garden. Okay, and so, because of that, setting up this, carving out this, relatively idyllic space in the chaos of this, of a primitive world, it's going to be garden-like, you know, reminiscent of the, you know, the majesty and pleasantry of that vast garden on the constellation headquarters. They're saying that's just almost always the case, that they draw upon that that linkage to help reinforce what the Adam and Eve come to do. Remember, the planetary prince reveals up to the system, local system level. The Adam and Eve reveal up to the constellation level. See, so it's very natural, because that's at the constellation level, the garden's there, to create this linkage. That's what they're saying. See, it's always, almost always part of this process of giving them a way to start to think about the cosmos up to the constellation level, up to the most highs. Yeah.
I always identify the Garden of Eden as the central focal point. One of the principal focal points would be the Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life is a shrub from Edentia, from the constellation headquarters. And that would be similar for all evolving planets, I would assume.
Right. See, and then that just, I didn't go into that, but see, that just further adds to it, you know, that you can get them to recognize that this Tree of Life, you know, literally was brought from, you know, that constellation headquarters that we're wanting you to think of, and when you refer to what we're calling the garden here, you know. So yeah, I mean, it's just all these different reasons why this is an important linkage to make. Yeah, just a second, there was a question back here first.
You know, Chris, one of the SOSs that I heard you on, you were talking about the constellation level, and maybe it was a couple of years ago. And what came out on that was they got together at the constellation headquarters, and they worshiped. Now, correct me, because I don't, you know, my
they
worship the mother,
they
not
worship
the father.
God, they worship God the mother.
Whereas you think of the planetary prince as just being the opposite. He's going to worship the father, right?
Well, I mean, that's an example when they mention that you know, they bring them together, you know, in worshipful recognition of God the Mother, because remember what they tell you about, you know, in the Supreme Papers about your local universe career. I mean, the growth of your soul throughout the entire local universe career is dominated by the strengthening of your relationship to God the Mother, and that you don't really add to your initiation of a relationship to God the Father that you got, you know, back on your mortal world, until you leave the local universe. You know, it takes you the whole local universe really to build up the conformity to the cosmos, you know, relationship to God the Mother, to balance out that profound initiation that you got in relationship to the Father, so that the two are in proper balance when you leave the local universe. Here, we're going to do Gene here first. Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering about the material sons and daughters. Their headquarters is on the system level?
Yeah, like they were just mentioning, you know, the material sons and daughters are headquartered, in our case, on Gerasim.
And the Lenonadec sons, their headquarters are where?
Well, you know, they technically have their worlds around Salvington, you know, and, you know, but of course they're, you know, stationed and functioning at the, you know, within the local system, either at the headquarters or down on the planets.
Okay. I was probably just looking for a connection that I'm not there.
But as long as you mentioned that, see, there's another example of how, you know, you want to think about the whole, the mortal worlds as being part of the local system in a very direct way. I mean, you have Lenonadex for the local system, and, you know, there's two flavors, you know, but basically they're all in the local system. It's, you know, it's not like you have another order of suns that, you know, drops down below the Lenonadex at the local system headquarters. See, so that's why I was saying it isn't, it's a quasi-level, you know, really, to go down to the planets. Okay, one more little thing you want to bring in?
I was just going to say that, tying it into this, Adam and Eve appear to me, you know, I was just thinking planetary helpers help Adam and Eve versus administrators help the planetary prince. Right. I mean, you know, it's just more definitively more of a mother-like planetary helpers. That's more mother-like, and, you know, and the administrators tend to be more father-like. You know?
Right. You certainly have those. Yeah. I mean, the Lenonadex, whether they're at the, you know, whether they're the primaries or the secondaries, you know, whether at the local system headquarters or down in the worlds, are definitely the downstepped expression of the universal father. I mean, that's the descending sons. That's, you know, they're serving in the universal father's stead. Yeah, very much, very directly. okay, so the other things in here, you know, besides that, a bit of appreciating how, you know, both, you know, in truth and then in the use of the word Eden and the revelation, you know, they're trying to also stress this linkage between the garden and the constellation headquarters. Notice what they say there right after that, voices in the garden, quote unquote, in the middle of the paragraph there. These seraphim are of invaluable service to the planetary atoms in all their projects for the physical and intellectual upstepping of the evolutionary races. So that's reminding you of how directly tied they are. So obviously when there isn't an Adam and Eve that are doing what they're supposed to be doing, right, see, that's why a lot of them were taken off. Now, we know one of these voices of the garden definitely wasn't taken off because
she wrote
all of the Adam and Eve papers. What's the name of that voice of the garden? Solonia, right. And not only was Solonia, you know, a voice of the garden, and, you know, basically the actual voice that is, the story in the Bible is coming down to from, the one who actually engaged Adam and Eve. But Solonia, another reason why Solonia stayed when most of the planetary helpers was taken off is Solonia is in charge of all of the planetary helpers, or was, and, you know, I guess still is then. So another reason why that would stay. And that just reminds you, the fact that a voice of the garden was in charge of all of the planetary helper angels, you know, you see the subcategory one again. It's the real executive, subcategory. All right, so that everything seems to be, you know, pretty holding to the pattern real solidly. And so then, like they say at the end, after the Adamic falling wrench, some of these seraphim were left, and we know one of those some was Solonia. And then, like I said, you know, assigned to Adam's successors and authority. So initially, you know, it was Melchizedek receivers, of course. But now, like I said before, it's that facet of what the resident governor general does that is in some way a substitute for what an Adam and Eve, you know, would do. But we know it's in a pretty limited mode because some of the revelators are speculating, hoping, you might even actually say, that when Machiavelli to Melchizedek assumes planetary prince, that he also definitively assumes the role of material sun. You know, not literally as a biologic uplifter, but he takes over this, you know, this whole bit about these projects of the physical and intellectual upstepping of the evolutionary races, all the things that the Adam and Eve normally do, besides literally, you know, making offspring that mate with the evolutionary races, but all of that management of the physical, you know, and foundational intellectual, you know, nature, that they're, you know, they're really hoping that he takes on that role.
Or they say,
right, right, right. Some of them speculate you might bring back, you know, the Adam and Eve's children from Edentia and all these sorts of things. But like I said, there are some revelators that think that the way that's going to be solved is that Machiavelli will just assume that role because he could, you know, he, unlike a Lenonadec, a Melchizedek knows of the material things very well, you know, especially ours was literally incarnated, okay? So knows it very intimately, you know, and he'll take over that. And we know we need someone because the genetics is getting, you know, squishier and squishier on this planet as time goes by. So someone, you know, that's why those revelers are going, boy, I sure hope. Right. You have to wonder if maybe it's the life carriers, you know, that might be one of the, some of those that are saying, boy, I hope that... because I don't even know quite how this is going to work, you know, and I'm a life carrier.
Right. We didn't design it for this.
Right. So anyway, yeah, not to go too far astray, but that, anyway, so that, you know, whatever limited aspect there is right now with the resident governor general, they are helping. So, you know, you kind of wonder, you know, what's a day in the life of Solonia? You know, she's not continuing to write, you know, papers for the Fifth Biblical Revelation. What does she do on a daily basis, you know?
She's working in my
You know? Okay. All right, so that's that one. Now, we won't dwell on it here, but if you just glance at the next three subgroups, where you have the spirits of brotherhood, the souls of peace, the spirits of trust, remember how when we were going through the other ones, you know, in the second one, we had things related to mercy and justice, and then we were seeing the coordination at the various levels, the unity, the associativity, and the individuality levels in the third group, and we were seeing teachers of various flavors in the fourth group, and you glance down just at those names, and okay, I'm not really seeing, you know, how that fits in. So let's just kind of set that aside. I mean, if you think about those in kind of a generalized sense of helping our relationship to the bigger picture that all those seraphim, you know, that we've been talking about in subcategories 2, 3, 4, or about, you know, these are definitely doing that. Spirits of brotherhood, you know, souls of peace, spirits of trust, you know, trust and peace and brotherhood, fostering our relationship to those higher facts. So yeah, in general, but the specificity is not quite as clear. So let's just set that aside and let's just get into these three groups and see what pattern we see here a little bit more definitively when that's brought down to the rubber meeting the road here on a world. Okay.
Two, the spirits of brotherhood. It should be apparent that when Adam and Eve arrive on an evolutionary world, the task of achieving racial harmony and social cooperation among its diverse races is one of considerable proportions. Seldom do these races of different colors and various natures take kindly to the plan of human brotherhood. These primitive men only come to realize the wisdom of peaceful interassociation as a result of ripened human experience and through the faithful ministry of the seraphic spirits of brotherhood. Without the work of these seraphim, the efforts of the material sons to harmonize and advance the races of an evolving world would be greatly delayed. And had your Adam adhered to the original plan for the advancement of Urantia, by this time, these spirits of brotherhood would have worked unbelievable transformations in the human race. In view of the Adamic default, it is indeed remarkable that these seraphic orders have been able to foster and bring to realization even as much of the brotherhood as you now have on Urantia.
Okay. Like I said, a number of things I want you to appreciate here. Always notice how masterly they use the language. And when they say different colors and varied natures, they don't take kindly to the plan of human brotherhood. You know, I mean, you got to chuckle out of that. Okay, but you know, remember the word kindly. You know, kin-like. Right, we're talking about brotherhood. See, there's nothing natural about you know, genuine kin-likeness, other than what little bit of you can kind of have programmed into us and stuff within a literal biologic family unit. But even then, I think everyone knows families that aren't manifestations of brotherly love. Okay? There's nothing automatic about it, even, a husband and a wife and their children, okay, let alone beyond that. That's why they use that, you know, that literal, you know, so they were trying to get you to remind yourself of the literal meaning of kind, to be kin-like. Okay, now, we've talked about this issue of brotherhood. Now, there's other spots in the book where they try to get us to understand how you actually achieve this long-desired dream of the brotherhood of man. And remember how they stress that what gives you the potential for the brotherhood of man is being kindred spirits, which is basically given to you by grace. I mean, even without a universal bestowal of thought adjusters, you know, and the Spirit of Truth poured out upon all flesh, you have one Holy Spirit that every human is encircled in. You know, so that, you know, there's a kindred spirit at a very foundational level, just with the Holy Spirit. You know, we're all kindred spirits. We're one spirit ministry. And you just augment that with having one Spirit of Truth that everyone is encircled in, you know, and even though it's, you know, individuated adjusters, we know that they are very intimately as one voice because of their very high nature. Forever, from Andon and Fonta all the way to today, you have just basically, automatically, by grace, the fact of kindred spirits. It may not be highly gripped with your faith grasp by mankind, but it's there. The potential for the brotherhood is there. The kindred spirit fact is there. So what are the spirits of brotherhood up to then? Okay, it says spirits of brotherhood. So, as we've been saying, all of these seraphim are adding a dynamic to the spirit ministry that we're linked into, that all of us are in common and circuited in. What is this particular dynamic doing? It's obvious that it's very much focused on that foundation of the kindred spirits and trying to foster it downward into full blossom as kindred minds. Because you have to be kindred minds to actualize the brotherhood of man. Kindred spirits potentialize it, kindred minds actualize it. And so their job is to try to foster that transition from potential to actual, so that it isn't just vainly hoping for the future of the brotherhood of man, you know, as a bunch of kindred spirits, endlessly pining for it, never, you know, experiencing it. With, you know, so that's their job, to make it so it doesn't take forever for that process building upon that foundation of being kindred spirits, and beginning to achieve kindred minds. Okay, so that's what they're doing. They're adding a flavor to the spirit ministry that tends to foster the actualization of that potential. You know, it doesn't just encourage the presence with the potential. It tries to encourage you doing something with that potential. That's what they're up to. No one needs to, you know, really augment the fact of the potential. You know, Creative Mother Spirit is there doing that. I mean, is very intimate with you, working on making that voice heard, you know, within you. Okay, so that's their job, fostering from kindred spirits to kindred minds. And let's see, what else do we have there? So then they say, in view of the Adamic default, okay, and they say that after they've just said that if there hadn't been a default, there would have been unbelievable transformations. So they're obviously quite effective. So not surprisingly, even without all of the proper biologic uplift and blending and everything that we should have, they're still reasonably effective. So this is a powerful quickening influence, obviously. That's probably another reason why they say it's so sad to record, you know, that we don't try to have a relationship with all of these ministries that are trying to help us, because some of them are very potent, and we would see some significant effects if we just had the slightest, you know, effort on our parts, you know, by choice, by personality, will, consecration, to allow this to start happening instead of spending all of our days muddling around in material, you know, soap operas, you know, that we just endlessly delight in. Did you hear about, you know, and this sort of stuff? But we just, you know, that consumes our day-to-day life. You know, and so these poor seraphim are just, oh man, you know, how long must I twiddle my thumbs? If they would just give me something, anything. Yeah.
Until the planet is one color, we're not going to have an effective real brotherhood.
Right. I mean, right. Yeah. We know that a lot of these things are going to be long delayed.
Right.
You know, eventually, one way or another, this will blend. Yeah.
I'm reminded of one of my favorite parts in the Jesus Papers, when Simon turns to the master and says, "Are all men the sons of God?"
Yeah, says, right.
Yes,
yeah.
Simon, this is the message that we're about to give.
Right.
All men are the sons of God. And that, to me, is the spirit behind the, you know, the ability to be able to create brotherhood when you right. remember that.
Right. Right. See, I mean, that's the thing. See, that, I mean, if you just definitively hold in your mind that we are all kindred spirits, it's a fact. Not because of something we've done. It's just we are made that fact in our higher lives. But it's sad to record that so few of us really live in our higher spheres of potential, where that's just there, just naturally, the kindred spirit fact is in play if we all choose to not just be down there churning with the material things. You know, and so if, like they say in paper 16, section 6, I mean, to get most of this stuff going, it's very simple. It's not something complicated. All you have to do is reflect. But most people go their entire day and never pull back on the reins for 1 second. Go, now wait a minute, let me think about that for a second. They never do that. They're just gung-ho, you know, with their agenda the whole day. You know, and all of these ministries are above that, waiting patiently for you to put your foot on the brake, pull back on the reins, whatever analogy you want to use. Just stop for a second and try to step back and try to put the details of the moment in front of a backdrop, in front of a context, take a look at what context these events are occurring in, rather than fixating just on the details and trying to micromanage them. What's the big picture? Stop. And it just the second you do that, the second you pull back and see the details in a context, all these ministries kick in. It, you know, you don't have to, you know, move tab A to slot B or anything. You don't have to have some technique. There's no recipe that you have to do. It's just all automatic. If you pull back, if you just put yourself in that initial reflective state, they all start. Now, the more you take delight in cultivating and getting that reflective state more and more dynamic and whatnot, okay, yeah, and then you start to get all the things going, you know, in spades. But to get them started is trivial. It doesn't require any technique at all other than just pulling back and stopping for a second. It's like, okay, let me think about this for a second. You know, is this the best approach? Let me try to project forward, you know, to tomorrow and you know, try to see some temporal and spatial context. Okay. All right, so this influence of trying to get you moving toward kindred minds moves you right into the next group of seraphim. Okay, notice they aren't the spirits of peace. They're the souls of peace. Okay, they're about what could begin to happen if there's something besides mere kindred spirits. You actually, you know, start to get some genuine kindred mind phenomenon, some genuine brotherhood of man, that peace on earth thing is now possible. Kindred spirits, you know, can't remotely give you peace on earth. You know, they can't even give you the brotherhood of man. If you start to see actually move, you know, to some measure of brotherhood, these seraphim now have something they can do on top of that. When they say souls like this, you know, what they mean most immediately is, if you can understand it in the hourglass analogy of your mind, that you have, you know, the lower domain of unspiritualized mind, just kind of the raw adjutant ministry, you know, that allows you to think and function on the basic material level here and allows you to relate to the outer world, you know, the external world. But above that, in the upper domain of the hourglass, the spiritualized mind, you know, any measure of nature, genuine personal nature in that upper domain gets copied into soul by the adjuster. See, so, you know, it's effectively soul, not literally soul in the upper domain of the hourglass. You know, it's not a Marantia energy system up there, but it's what's copied into a Marantia energy system as a soul. It's and a lot of times in the book, when they say soul, they don't literally mean the Marantia object. They mean the upper domain of the hourglass. You know, mind. The soul-like mind. Okay? See, that domain where a kindred mind can be. Okay? The souls of peace. See, so they're going to start to try to do something with that. Measure of kindred mind consciousness that you have, a mind that has consecrated itself to the universal harmony of God the Mother, not just the kindred spirit mind. It's consecrated its will to the perfect will of God the Father. Something greater than that, a kindred mind, and so they can work with that consecration of mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, that soul-like mind. All right, so let's see what they say about that.
Three, the souls of peace. The early millenniums of the upward strivings of evolutionary men are marked by many a struggle. Peace is not the natural state of the material realms. The worlds first realize peace on earth and goodwill among men through the ministry of the seraphic souls of peace. Although these angels were largely thwarted in their early efforts on Urantia, Vavona, chief of the souls of peace in Adam's day, was left on Urantia and is now attached to the staff of the resident governor general. And it was this same Vavona who, when Michael was born, heralded to the worlds as the leader of the angelic host, glory to God in Havona, and on earth peace and goodwill among men.
Okay, before you read that last little bit, notice, what they did is they invoked, Luke chapter 2, the famous story about Jesus' birth there in Luke, with that line, repeating, in part, it twice here, peace on earth and goodwill among men. It's another fun little example of, we all know how it actually is there, like in the King James, glory to God in the highest. And so they replace the highest with the literalness of the highest, Havona. Okay. And doing that also reminds us that, remember, no human heard that. And actually, that was, of course, not sung. And, no angels were literally putting forward that sequence of words, glory to God in Havona and on earth peace. Okay, that's a line out of the Bible, which embodies the truth of what was actually sung by those angels. Now remember, that's the way this works. When you have things in quotes, they're quoting the truth, not the fact. So don't think simplistically. The truth of what was sung is expressed by those human words. The revelators are told if there's human words that are adequately expressive of the truth, you are not allowed to use anyone else's words, including your own. You must use the human's words if they are adequate to get at the truth. Okay, so it's up to us to not be simplistic and just, they've just validated the exact sequence of letters in the New Testament in Luke chapter 2. No, okay? You can't see what they want you to get. The truth is not those words. What's the truth? Can you find the truth that flows through that sequence of words? Okay? And that truth was sung. If you can feel that truth, you can put yourself back and effectively hear them singing again. Okay, so that's one issue.
That issue quickly. How would an angel, a soul of peace on this planet, herald that to the worlds? How would it get from here to there? Maybe being too literal, I don't know.
The most straightforward way is mentioned at the end of this section.
Okay.
but try to remind me, and we'll notice that.
Is it through a human?
So there's that. Now notice, what they said here about this group of angels. They said a lot of these planetary helpers were taken away. Apparently, every one of the souls of peace was taken away, but one. Right. See, the leader. In other words, there's not a lot that can be done in this regard here without the biologic uplift and everything. So that's a little reminder before we get to the last paragraph. You notice this one has two paragraphs. It's got a first one that really doesn't seem, if you think about it, it doesn't really tell you anything about what the souls of peace do. And then it's got a little footnote paragraph, okay? But you should be suspicious at this point that it's something of a very fairly advanced or a relatively advanced nature that they're up to normally. Yeah, we were just talking about it. It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch have take delight in cultivating, these qualities of courageous and independent cosmic thinking that move you from being kindred spirits to kindred minds. There's very little kindred mind functioning. So, these angels just aren't here. There's no work for them here. Okay? If it wasn't so sad to record, we might get some planetary helpers sent to minister to us. But there's really not much for them to do right now because it is fundamentally an advanced thing. Most of us don't have souls beyond what we were given by grace. That initial measure of soul-like mind in the upper domain of the hourglass is it's encircuited there by grace and copied by, you know, into that little embryonic soul. It's sad to record that so few people have gone beyond that. And these angels can't minister to just that embryonic level. I mean, that's, you know, there's really nothing, no meat there to work with. Okay. Okay. All right. So you see how it's kind of suggesting that just in how they started out. But they wanted you to have something to hold on to. You know, and it's interesting to note that that angel, Vavona, which they actually coined a name for here again, saw how hopeful an event that was to have the bestowal son, you know, out of sequence like that and everything. It's like, you know, I bet you in the not too distant future, there'll be something for me to do here. I want to lead the song that sings of this hopeful future. One day there will be minds that strive for quality of thinking on this world. You let the spirit of truth and the universal bestowal of thought adjusters work for a few centuries or a few millennia, and this is going to get fun. There's going to be something to work with here. Okay, so that's why. See, that's, you know, think about why they're telling you that. Why is it logical that that angel would take the lead on this? You know, it's not because it's bored. It's like, well, I guess I could be choir director. Okay, I mean, think truthfully about it. Right? Right? You want to think truthfully about it. There's some truth to that. Okay.
Not slothful animals.
All right, so now notice what they throw in here in this last little paragraph.
In the more advanced epochs of planetary evolution, these seraphim are instrumental in supplanting the atonement idea by the concept of divine attunement as a philosophy of mortal survival.
Okay, so there's a couple of profound things. One, you know, interesting little disclosure there. It is common. Basically, every world goes through an atonement doctrine phase.
Not just Paul.
Right, it's not just here. And it's not just because, you know, you can have a perfect planetary prince and Adam and Eve, and there's still a long phase on that world where you have what? You have the atonement doctrine. You have the atonement idea. Okay?
It doesn't make any sense.
Sacrifice. It makes sense to a primitive mind.
Yeah, like
what worlds don't have primitive mortals? None. Okay, every world has primitive mortals. It's an inexorable part of the evolutionary process. The challenge is, you know, kind of what John was going, oh, that's interesting. Yes, see, it should be interesting to you. You should suddenly go, so I'm being pretty simple-minded and elitist when I constantly look down my nose at people who believe the atonement doctrine, you know, is there some horrendous benighted individuals? No, they're normal. Okay? God made us all to go through that. You know, every world goes through that. Okay, these ideas of what's normal on a world was also there in the previous paragraph. If you were thinking in the bigger context of the book. When they said in that second sentence there in the first paragraph, peace is not the natural state of the material realms. If you know the whole revelation, you should have thought of something. You should have said, yeah, I know what is the quote-unquote natural state. Okay, peace is not the natural state. What is?
War.
War. Right? There's that direct sentence in the book. If you have forgotten it, go and look it up again. War is the natural state. God makes every mortals on every world to go through war. Remember, war is one of the four indispensables. It's impossible to get a world to light and life without, for a certain stretch of time, that world having war to push it along. It's the only way you can evolve a light and life world is through war, not through peace. Peace is not an indispensable. That's just an inevitable, you know, end point. Okay? It's not a technique. Okay? War is a technique, an indispensable technique. And that's why we're made that way. We're naturally, our natural state is war. Okay? And, you know, see, so the atonement idea is natural. I mean, what's another one of those indispensables? Slavery. You remember the four indispensables to the progression of early civilization, you know, and it's important, the progression part and the civilization part, I'm being very precise, the four indispensables to the progressing of early civilization: slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. There's just four indispensables to that process with civilization. Okay, and yeah, so slavery. You know, like they tell you, in other words, oh, that's interesting. Remember when they tell you that almost always on a world, if you have secondary sanghiks, the primaries enslave them, you know, in a pattern. Blue enslaves indigo, for instance.
Slaves,
you know, red enslaves orange, yellow enslaves green, and blue enslaves indigo. Okay, that's natural. That's not an aberration. That's the way God made it. That's an indispensable part of the process. Those, you know, I'm stressing on this because I want you to see how, what's kind of being challenged here, it's similar to what we saw last time. There's a lot more than immediately meets the eye. The big challenge here again in this group of angels, how it relates to us, is this bias that we all have when we get initialized by the Father in relationship to Spirit. That kindred spirit thing, this unity bias that produces all kinds of false ideas in our head that are not, you know, they're not true because they're not tied to the fact of evolution, and evolution is the Father's way. And it's very, very difficult for your idealism to swallow some of these statements in the book about that. Don't kid yourself. I mean, let yourself be... totally disgusted with what they're saying you have to somehow identify with, that war is a natural state, that slavery is an indispensable and stuff like that. It's not an eternal. See, and that's the problem. Your spiritual consciousness always thinks in eternal terms, existential terms. And so when it hears war is indispensable, it doesn't actually hear war is indispensable. It hears war is an eternal necessity. You know, and rebels against that horrid thought. How could you? It's like, no, I didn't say that. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. See, you have to argue with your spiritual consciousness. Get it to see time. Stop. It constantly confuses things because it interprets everything existentially. You know, it's not that light and life has to have war in it or slavery in it. That's illogical. Right? But evolution in the early stages have to have those. Yeah.
So after we've gone through the statement, we need to keep moving forward so we don't have to go back through those. Take stock in what we've gone through already.
Yeah.
Instead of having to do those overs.
It's a hopeful sign. In terms of the transition from the four indispensables of the early progress of civilization to the four indispensables of the advancing stages of civilization. Oh, advancing. In the more advanced epochs, they're referring to, if you actually get to that second stage of progressing civilization, where the indispensables are true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness, okay, then these angels have something to do. If you'd like to have the souls of peace having something to do, you need to work on this transition. Being part of a transition from early stage to the advanced stage. Okay? And that involves you taking delight in cultivating. Because look what else they say there. You know, you supplant the atonement idea by what? By the divine attunement, consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. It's like, well, how do you know that's the consecration? As a philosophy. Right? The second stage, that advancing stage, is about personal living philosophies. Actually having personal living philosophies in the upper domain of the hourglass of every individual that's capable of it on a world, then there's something for souls of peace to do.
Kindred minds.
And right, there's kindred minds. That's what personal living philosophies are. They're kindred minds because there is the philosophy and you're attuning to it as an individual personal living philosophy in the upper domain of your hourglass. Yeah.
You know, we're so arrogant. I constantly think, well, of course, that was all well and good, the atonement doctrine and slavery and war and all such, for the early stages of, look at us, I mean, good, we've got the internet. I got cable, but that's really of no real, we are in a very early stage of civilization, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, think about, remember, we used to have the atonement doctrine as a very positive thing, but then we got enlightened, quote unquote,
yeah,
with primitivism, followed by pre-primitivism, which we call postmodernism, but is actually pre-primitivism. How do we know it's pre-primitivism? Well, for instance, you've got a majority of people today that say, at one, like I need to be at one with some, you know, fairy tale about God. I'm so much more sophisticated than that. See, okay, atonement is primitive. Thinking you don't even need that is pre-primitive. Okay? This world could, you know, right itself a lot if there were people who, you know, even had just a primitive taboo about this again. It's like, oh boy, I better try to put myself at one with, you know, the volcano god or he's going to smite me. That could really help. We got a lot of people with a lot of self-righteousness that need some tempering.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is some good in the atonement doctrine. I mean, I know I talked to my mother, who's 91 years old, and she's an Episcopal minister, and, you know, she's saying, gosh, you know, do you think I'll go to heaven? She, you know, she's obviously going to heaven.
Yeah.
And she says, I know I'm going to go because Jesus died for my sins.
Right.
And even knowing, you know, and I'm not going to sit there and tell her, you know, but even when I was a kid, I thought about the whole concept. It didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Exactly.
Because you'd always go, okay, I can go out and sin, you know, because he's died for my
back.
That could really work.
I mean, if he died to forgive my sins, I better have some sins to forgive. I got to work on that.
but there is some good in that process, or in, you know, in that aspect amongst people who really, for them, it's the feeling that they are comforted by and feeling that they are safe and so on and so forth because, you know, this happened. And therefore, and boy, I tell you, it's not something you can, that I found, that you can really, you really want to get in and try and explain that away from them right now.
Right.
No.
At this stage of their life, it's up what you said.
Don't take it away from them.
I mean, do you delight in chopping the legs off of little babies?
No, I don't.
Right. I mean, you know, people need to think about what they're doing when they try to take those initial things. And look at what they just told
you. Your answer book does a pretty good job of this.
Well, yeah, that's why the fifth epical revelation is not for those people.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to actually rip prayer out of them, you know, rip the atonement out of them, you know, rip their use of the word faith as a word, you know, that basically means belief. And, you know, no. What does even the Bible say about you? It would be better if a millstone were hanged about your neck and you were cast into the sea. Right? You do not want to do that. The universe is not going to look kindly on you if you do that. They're going to look very, very negatively on you. Okay?
This is a process.
Just the same way they looked on Lucifer when he went to the probationary nursery. Okay, that's the way they'll look at you if you do that. Okay, so very serious stuff. Yeah, but you see what we're at here. Okay, you see the process that they're trying to show you. These angels are involved in this evolution of moving into the advancing stage.
There's only one of them.
Well, you see that, well, yeah, because it's right, there's nothing to do right now. Okay, and how...
We're screwed.
Right, well...
Yeah, he's underemployed.
Like I said...
We're quivering on the break and the ship's out of the harbor on the open seas, come on. It's got to be happening soon.
Remember how this works. It's all in our free will hands. If we start to choose to be something that can be ministered to, you know, will we find the ministry not there when we need it? No. I mean, how sad is it to record? It's so sad to record that that all of the soul of peace ministry that's needed for this whole planet can be done by one angel. Okay, that's how sad it is to the record. Remember how, you know, with your guardian seraphim, you know, initially you're in your seventh circle, you're in a group of 1,000. Because, you know, one pair of angels can handle 1,000 very immature, you know, little children like that. There's not much to do with any single individual. It takes 1,000 of them in order to, you know, actually have a handful for those.
One angel is handling 7 billion people.
Yeah, one angel is handling the whole ball of wax. That's how sad it is to record. Okay, they're trying to stress this. Okay, so this is what we're up to here. And I mean, just, you know, one other thing about this transition. You know, remind yourself again why. You know, you could have only one angel and have that be adequate. One of the definitive things that marks the transition from that early stage of progressing civilization to the advanced stage, nation status is the threshold of that transition. When you finally achieve nation status and are evolving into territorial state, you know, where you have a nation under laws, you know, we actually go from mores to laws, codifying things and, you know, having a concept of law and putting yourself under that law.
In a legal tradition.
Okay, that transition, okay, so, you know, look at the world around you. Most of the planet is still struggling to get to nation. Most are still in tribal and clan status. Yeah. I mean, even the immediate precursor of the United States, Great Britain, still has a parliamentary government, which is a form of democracy that's set up to handle peoples that are in tribal mode. Okay? To actually go from tribal to some measure of genuine nation, not just nation in name only, vainly hoping for the future of nation life, okay, but actual nation life, see, the United States is the only ones that have really done this so far.
We're struggling.
And we are very aggressively preaching a gospel of being tribes again. Yeah. You know, we should all have hyphens on our names and, you know, such and so American and whatnot. You know, and dividing ourselves, you know, all of the politicians get power by dividing us into tribes, and we make money, like on the internet, by trying to find a tribe and playing to them. I mean, this is a whole consciousness that we've developed, this tribal mentality, success through tribalism. Okay, so again, when most people are in a tribal mode, I mean, you know, we love sports because of the tribal aspect.
Come on, don't go on sports.
Yeah. I'm going to say all those things that you're not supposed to say in polite company. religion, politics, sports. Right.
Tattoos.
Sports is not team.
Right. I mean, we delight in, you know, and all these things that are tribal. Okay? Just you've got to take a deep breath and face that fact. That's part of why this revelation is in my lap, is because the one group of people that were really looking like they were moving across that threshold are now choosing to take themselves back across the line. Okay? And those people say, oh, and war is horrible. It's like, well, if you pull yourself back across the line, that's an indispensable if you're in that mode. If you don't want war, don't put yourself back on the side where war is indispensable. You've got to be one nation under God. You know, to be a nation requires something that transcends all of the differences of humans. God. You have to be a nation under God. You can't be a nation under skin color or geographic location or something like this. You have to be a nation under something that transcends our animal origin nature. You have to be a nation under God. There's only one nation under God on the planet. Okay, and a lot of those people that are in that nation under God would like to eliminate the under God part.
They think that's what causes the problem.
Because they think that's really problematic. That's delusional. Et cetera. We see, this is the problem. Okay, yeah, Gene, you have something there?
Well, I just wanted to mention that part of the philosophy in this transitional stage has to be to understand and appreciate what the first four indispensables do for us.
Yeah.
Because we need to figure out how to do that for ourselves without having it done for us through these indispensables. That's mm-hmm. the only way we can
right.
move beyond those things.
Right. Can you see how you have four facts of indispensables, but there's one truth? Can you see how there's one truth that threads through slavery and war and God consciousness? It's like, no, there's not any similarity at all. Well, then you're part of the side to record. That's our challenge, to go beyond fact and begin to see truth. There's a truth that flows through that, and it's one truth. And like Gene's hit it right on the head there. Can you begin to appreciate the truth that flows through slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive so that you can let go of the fact scaffolding and follow the truth forward into a different set of facts that are wrapped around that same truth? If you know not the truth, you'll never make that transition. If you just say, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. If that's your mantra, that song, the war is good for absolutely nothing, then you have no relationship to the truth. The more you hold that mantra in your mind, the more you're cutting yourself off from this process of moving forward. You think you're doing this wonderful peace-identified thing. Well, you're not. There's one angel that's handling the whole planet. You're not doing much peace stuff, guaranteed, because there's one angel handling the whole damn thing on the planet, okay? So we're very delusional about peace, is what this is telling us. We got a lot of work to do to be genuinely doing something that can be ministered to by a soul of peace. We have souls only by grace, mostly, okay? Embryonic souls. All right. I don't want to belittle that. I don't want to continue to harp on that. I belabor it. Wrong B word. But we tend to belittle it. But I want to labor on it enough that it sinks in. Don't be fearful. Don't get feeling hopeless. Draw upon some courage and take on the challenge. This is what we should be focusing on. Instead of trying to somehow manufacture peace, supply the favorable conditions for the souls of peace. The peace will come naturally if you've supplied the favorable conditions. And those favorable conditions are not just magically thinking that you can somehow manipulate peace into existence on the planet. Okay? We cannot cause growth. We can only supply the favorable conditions. So this stuff is very, very relevant, again, to these problems with our spiritual consciousness and what we need to do a better job on the favorable condition thing.
It's one other thing, okay. In this glory to God and the hope of all.
Yeah.
Do you remember when it says, talks about, when a bestowal son comes, they normally initiate a time of peace,
right.
And then
right.
Jesus said,
right.
don't get too ahead
right.
of yourself.
Right. Right.
It's not going to happen the way
right.
it normally would happen. Would
right.
that be one of the reasons that this particular angel, when Jesus bore him, might have thought, hey, this is going to be a good opportunity here.
Right. Again, that's related. Even though Vivona knew that you wouldn't literally have him actualizing peace, you know, as the Prince of Peace, the potential was definitively there. And that angel is wise enough to not be so biased about the difference between potential and actual. That angel sees that potential as a literal fact and sings to it, sings of the glory of that potential, just as if it was the actual, right? Okay? That you know. See, so we have, you know, we have everything to sing about too, but there's a lot of hard work that needs to be done for that to actualize in the outer life, as opposed to just being visualized in the inner life. Okay, and that work from going from kindred spirits to kindred minds is what gets it translated from the inner life to the outer life. A kindred spirit is pure inner life. A kindred mind has an outlet to the outer life. Right? Your mind is your associating mechanism between the inner life and the outer life. If there's no kindred mind, the same, no conformity of mind to the cosmos, that, you know, potential can't flow from the inner life to the outer life. And that's why it doesn't, that's why we can't see it with our material eyes. We can't get it out. No matter how much we squint, we can't get that spirit to magically pop out here in the matter. You have to have something that transitions from spirit to matter. Mind. Mind is the bridge between the spirit and the matter. Because this is not a spirit world out here. This is not a spirit object. This is a material object that I'm sitting on. Okay? All right. Now, number four is against spirits. So let's see what they're getting at there.
Four, the spirits of trust. Suspicion is the inherent reaction of primitive man. The survival struggles of the early ages do not naturally breed trust. Trust is a new human acquisition brought about by the ministry of the planetary seraphim of the Adamic regime. It is their mission to inculcate trust into the minds of evolving men. The gods are very trustful. The Universal Father is willing freely to trust himself, the adjuster, to man's association.
Okay, just one little thing there, setting the stage for what else they say here. Why would it be that suspicion is the inherent reaction of primitive men? If we weren't designed like that, that would be problematic, because war is the natural state. If you didn't have the complement of that fact, suspicion,
you'd be dead.
You'd be dead. Right? It goes hand in hand. You know, they've got to build suspicion into us enough to handle that indispensable of war, you know, or everyone's, you know, anyone of any consequence is going to be killed.
You know? Chris, is that a short-term adjutant response?
Yeah, I mean it's an, you know, it's an in the moment sort of a thing that, you know, in many ways, but you kind of lift it up into the fourth adjutant, you know, in a more long-term thing, and you sort of institutionalize and codify your suspicions and stuff, you know. But nonetheless, see, that's, you know, just why that is, why it has to be inherent, you know, built in, because of the war part being the natural state. All right, what else do they say?
This entire group of seraphim was transferred to the new regime after the Adamic miscarriage. And they have ever since continued their labors on Urantia. And they have not been wholly unsuccessful, since the civilization is now evolving, which embodies much of their ideals of confidence and trust.
Okay, So look at what you're getting at here. So they were all kept here. Oh, so they must still really, they must not be so much directly needing the kindred minds, but they can work at the spirit level. Oh yeah, they were called the spirits of trust. All right, see, the ideals of confidence and trust. Okay, so they're involved in another one of those developmental processes that you need to go through as an individual, where you mature your initial mere faith, spiritual faith, into soul trust. Okay, so These are, you know, these spirits of trust are just like the spirits of brotherhood. They're in this, you know, really at the spiritual level within you, but directing towards the mindle. You know, a spiritual faith goes to a soul trust. And they are directionizing that process for you. You know, they're helping to show you the way to go from faith to trust, to mature faith into trust. Or another way to talk about, you know, that level of trust is, you know, take your mere faith into living faith. You know, that's the other way the Revelators describe that, augmented faith. And look at the words they use here. Confidence. The root there is faith, of confidence. The fidence part, you know, is the word faith. You're with that. So you're with that faith. It's, you know, you're moving with it. You're in a living faith and trust. See, so they're actually, the way they're choosing the words is invoking that. So they don't, you know, they aren't involved in actually kind of doing, working with someone who has a full trust in place. They're trying to foster you getting to being a trusting individual.
Trusting in what?
Well, it starts with the cosmos. We talked about this last time. You know, remember the three duties? Duty to the cosmos, duty to others, duty to God. Okay? Trust is related to that. First, trusting the cosmos. No real harm can befall me, you say, like Jesus did. Why does he say that? Because he trusts the integrity of the cosmos. No real harm can befall me. I trust. See, that's not mere faith speaking. That's trust. That's living faith that can say that. You know, and it italicizes the word real. Remember how they do that in that passage? You know, to stress, you know, actual material harm could befall me, like they could crucify me. But no real harm can befall me, because the cosmos is integrous. And I've consecrated myself to that integrity. So I am integrous like the cosmos. I have confidence. I have a living relationship. I'm not fearfully faithful. I'm standing upright, you know, and I'm boldly walking forward in life. I have confidence. Okay, the other little thing that's in there, they haven't been wholly unsuccessful since a civilization is now evolving, which embodies much of their ideals of confidence and trust. What's a simple example of how we express this without going into all kinds of details, but just one simple thing that you ought to be able to think about. You are innocent until proven guilty. That's an expression, you're identifying with the ideal of trust. You're suspicious in the old mode if you're guilty until proven innocent. That's suspicion. That's an example right there.
When I was reading that, I couldn't help but think of confidence man. Mm-hmm. When I see the word confidence, I think confidence man. But if you think through how a confidence man works, he doesn't play on people's trust. He plays on their suspicions.
Spoken like a true confidence.
All right. See, there's all kinds of reflection here, but see, I just wanted to kind of seed that a little bit. And you can spend a lot of time reflecting on this. The more you think about this, make it a living recognition in your mind, the better, you know, instead of just listening to me talk about it. I want to kind of just motivate you, you know, thinking about what's coursing through these words here.
That's good.
All right, what else did I say?
In the more advanced planetary ages, the seraphim enhance man's appreciation of the truth that uncertainty is the secret of contented continuity.
Wow.
They help the mortal philosophers to realize that when ignorance is essential to success, it would be a colossal blunder for the creature to know the future. They heighten man's taste for the sweetness of uncertainty, for the romance and charm of the indefinite and unknown future.
Okay, so they do, when you do have a more advanced stage, like we've been talking about, they can take on some additional roles where they're kind of working directly with that trust stage, as opposed to trying to foster it into existence. Okay, and this is a wonderful passage to reflect on. The truth that uncertainty is the secret of contented continuity. Can you get to the point where you feel that, recognize that, what they're saying there? Have experienced the solidity of that truth. You notice, in advanced stage, you're talking about truth. Not the fact that uncertainty, but the truth that uncertainty is the secret of contented continuity. How does that feel? How does that experience go? If you knew exactly what was going to happen in the future, in the next hour, exactly how it was going to play out, we could build a robot, okay, that could navigate that future path. Okay, you make yourself a machine. You lower yourself to a machine level. When that's all that's going on, you know exactly what it's going to do, and you navigate. It's like, boy, am I, magnificent? No, you're an automaton. You're a robot, okay, a mechanism, and there's nothing profound about you. The profound thing is when you have not the slightest idea what's going to happen over the next hour or two. You just trustingly step into it, and you live organically in the moment. And you feel where things are, and you work with them and play with them and foster them, and you get to the other side, and it's like, oh, that was so cool. I mean, no robot could have done that. Only a human could see what is not visible to a robot's eyes. Okay? What you see when you navigate that hour or two can't be seen with your material eyes. Can only be seen with your insight. Okay? You see the potential that's in a moment, an interaction between individuals, and you strike step with it, and you foster it, and you help with them to actualize. And that's, you see that, and it's so satisfying, the contented continuity, to have that constant. That there's this constancy in your life, that you're always dynamically, cosmically in the moment, doing things that no mechanism can do.
You say that somewhere else, security without certainty or something.
Right. I mean, they say it in a lot of places. I mean, remember they tell you when you're in Havona and you finally get to see the Father and stuff, the big challenge is to get the uncertainty thing going again. To get you beyond the glory of the peak that you just climbed. Okay, and see the endless question mark after that.
Start to see the
so that you can become alive again. There's kind of a difficulty of like kind of dying practically, because this you have a hard time following this thread of truth through that glorious curtain of the Father. And following it through to the other side. That incredible, the indefinite and unknown future. This was with us forever.
Revel on disappointment.
There may be that too, but just the fact that you don't know what's going to happen. Don't try to micromanage your way to contentment. Genuine contentment comes when you let go and can exist in a trusting state where you just trust that you'll have what you need in the moment. If you've taken delight in cultivating, supplying the favorable conditions for that kind of dynamic cosmic relationship with the moment, it's just there and it just happens naturally, and it's very satisfying.
You still have to make decisions, right?
Right, you have to make all kinds of decisions. I got to decide whether or not to point to John right now and I'll ask this question because it's getting late. I've got...
That's a quick one.
One's really suspicious.
I think it's in Isaiah. Commit your ways to the Lord, trust in Him, And that last part is interpreted many different ways, and he will act, or it may say, or he will see it through.
Yeah.
In other words, commit your way. See, that's the key, and then trust. You know?
Or like what Jesus said to the apostles, don't fret about this, trust. When you get in the situation, you'll discover you have what you need.
And he will.
Right? He tried to encourage this in them. You know, you will finally feel alive when you can look back on having navigated something that you couldn't see the end from the beginning. You'll still be hungry at the end when you navigate something that you could see the end from the beginning, no matter how complicated it was. It'll never satisfy your soul. You'll still be left hungering for something. Is this all there is? Being a master at that manipulative act.
That only works, though, when you've taken time to create favorable.
Yeah, right. It only works then. Right. Without having taken time in advance to supply the favorable conditions, if you go into that giant question mark space, you will fail so catastrophically, the whole world will laugh at you. It'll be horrendous. Okay? You'll find nothing but disillusionment and disappointment in that stretch if you haven't done your work to begin with. But if you've done your work to begin with, and then just trust, don't try to pre-think everything you're going to say or do. Just go into it and organically work with it through the process. Okay, but it'll take you a while to get there. You know, children of God are not there by default. You know, you notice they said advanced planetary ages. So as an individual, you've got to start to have some of that kindred mind kind of consciousness. All right, we got now we got a big section here on the transporters. And here we see it again, of course. Well, we've got 20 minutes. We've got section 5. Section 5 on the transporters. It's lengthy and it's really wonderful, but it is pretty straightforward, you know. So we can just kind of re-identify ourselves with this, and I'll bring out a few things here. So go ahead.
5, the transporters. The planetary transporters serve the individual worlds. The majority of inseraphim beings brought to this planet are in transit. They merely stop over. They are in custody of their own special seraphic transporters. But there are a large number of such seraphim stationed on Urantia. These are the transport personalities operating from the local planets, as from Urantia to Gerasim.
We talked about it a little bit. So we're trying to understand how all these different levels of transporters work. You know, there's a logistics to this, and they're trying to help you with that. So it's not like everyone that's coming to or going away from this planet has to have one of this level of transporters. See, that's their. You know, if you hadn't figured that out already, they're stating it directly. You know, it's just if it really your journey starts here, okay, you get on one of these planes. But you know, if your journey started somewhere else, you got on a different transporter.
Yeah, a private jet.
Okay, all right. So they're just trying to help you with the logistics of that. So that's pretty straightforward.
Your conventional idea of angels has been derived in the following way. During moments just prior to physical death, a reflective phenomenon sometimes occurs in the human mind, and this dimming consciousness seems to visualize something of the form of the attending angel. And this is immediately translated into terms of the habitual concept of angels held in that individual's mind.
Okay, so you've got that transition where the adjuster is disconnecting, you know, and the adjuster is a little bit inside and a little bit outside at the same time, just as the inside is kind of fading away, like they're saying here. You know, where via that adjuster, you know, you might actually get some input of the fact of the angel there in the outer life next to you, ready to take possession of your soul. So they're saying that sometimes you get a little flash as through that adjuster conduit like that. Okay, but the really important part there is that last part. And this is so misunderstood. No matter how you get some sort of an input like this, some sort of a vision or visualization or anything like that, you know, even in a completely stable state, not when you're dying like this or anything, but no matter how carefully, you know, this is managed, that you're given a vision via the adjuster, this last thing remains unchanged. Okay? And this is immediately, whatever this is, whatever that input is, this is immediately translated into terms of the habitual concept of angels held in that individual's mind. Okay, and it's not just angels. Whatever you are getting, you know, input through that adjuster, which is obviously perfectly objective and well-formed, the instant that goes into your mind energy system, it is reformed to match your worldview. Your mind, you know, your mind, no matter how much you want it to do something magical, won't. It will only give form to something that fits into your pre-existent worldview, preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices. Okay? Now, it's impossible for you to see objectively. You can only see subjectively. So if you haven't supplied the favorable conditions to see less subjectively, then you'll see very less subject, you know, in a very limited subjective way. You know, you'll see mostly wholly, you know, childishly subjectively.
So if you always thought they had wings, you're going to see them with wings.
Yeah. Right. And that's true, just as true of what I'm seeing right now. You know, I look over there and I see certain shapes. But it's not like somehow my mind is forced to see, you know, those lights in the particular shape they are or something. That input could take any form in my mind. You know, there's all kinds of simple things that, you know, you can do to help yourself appreciate how subjective all of our senses are. You know, the simplest one, you know, that they do an experiment is, you know, they have a person wear glasses that have prisms in the lenses that flips everything upside down. You know, and so you're walking around and everything's upside down. But after a little while, your mind knows it's upside down and flips things right side up. Okay? And once you're in that mode where now everything is right side up again, if you take the glasses off, everything is upside down. And this is true in general. I mean, it's why, you know, why six witnesses tell you different stories. I mean, you have to understand, you know, we think that, oh no, I saw it, so it's real. No, it's immediately, what does it say there? It's immediately translated into terms of the habitual concept. So, I mean, you see what you expect to see. You can't do anything else. You've got to be very humble about, you know, what you think you saw or sensed or experienced, even if it's not coming from the outer life, even if it's something that's purely inner life, like an input from the adjuster. Okay? Now, if you expect to see hell, you'll see hell, and you'll come back with a story saying, no, there's proof now. Okay? I've seen it. No. Whatever you experienced was immediately translated into terms, right? We have to understand this. So people who think that they've had some spiritual experience where someone has contacted them or something, and they now have the objective facts that they can tell you. No, they don't. That's impossible. Okay? And they probably have some very primitive worldview that input came into, you know, and you know. So like Ezekiel sees something, and what is the description in Ezekiel like? You know, it's not what he saw, literally. It's not objectively what was there, but that's what he saw in his mind, because that whatever he saw, you know, the spaceship or whatever he saw, you know, the Midwayer ship or whatever it was, he immediately translated that into terms, and so there was, you know, angels and wheels and, you know, and all this sort of stuff. Because that's what his mind could see. You know, it couldn't see some advanced technological anti-gravity craft or something. Right? He can't form that image in his mind. Right? Okay.
So this section is on the transformer angels.
Transporter.
Transporter angels.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not seeing them when we die. Is that what they're saying?
Okay, so we haven't gotten to why they're sticking this in here yet. That's coming next in the next paragraph. Okay, but see, they're using this opportunity to throw in this little tidbit. That doesn't have a lot to do with transporter angels, see, but it has everything to do with what people believe they've experienced in all kinds of different ways. You need to be very humble about that. Remember, in conversion and mysticism, they say in general, if you think you've had a definitive transcendent experience, it's better to assume that you, got food poisoning. Okay? Than to believe that you just got a really objective vision from your adjuster and you now are the salvation of mankind. Right? Okay. All right. Why are they talking about this? Let's read the next thing here.
The erroneous idea that angels possess wings is not wholly due to the olden notions that they must have wings to fly through the air. Human beings have sometimes been permitted to observe seraphim that were being prepared for transport service. And the traditions of these experiences have largely determined the Urantia concept of angels. In observing a transport seraphim being made ready to receive a passenger for interplanetary transit, there may be seen what are apparently double sets of wings extending from the head to the foot of the angel. In reality, these wings are energy insulators, friction shields.
Okay, so, everything is straightforward there, except if you don't know our mythology. Okay, so in the mythology of literally what humans have called seraphim, Isaiah, and first Isaiah it is, Isaiah has a lot to do with this. Isaiah saw this habitual concept. He supposedly saw seraphim with six wings. Three sets of wings. Okay, if you look up seraphim in the dictionary or on Wikipedia or something like that, you'll see that they're supposed to have six wings. Okay, they're trying to explain to you why we have that. Okay, they have two of those sets, so four of the wings, are because of this habitual concept that's built up and is carried forward in people's minds, that's tied to seeing a transport seraphim, and they're two sets of energy insulators. Now, those six-winged seraphim, are described as having one set that covers, starting at the head, and one set that covers starting at the foot. See, like they're describing here, these two sets of energy shields. You got one pair that, go this way, and the other pair goes this way, coming from the two ends of the transport seraphim. Okay, but there's that third set of wings. Why does Isaiah see that, or other people see that? Well, because the habitual concept that, that's all fine and dandy for somehow like covering them up or something, but they've got to get from point A to point B, so they've got to have another set so they can fly.
That was his own mind.
Right, so whatever the heck he saw, who knows what he saw, but what he saw in his mind was the classic six-winged thing, because that's what you're expecting to see, okay?
What strikes me is that the transporter angel doesn't prepare himself or herself. Mm-hmm. She is prepared.
Right.
So are these insulator shields, these friction shields, added to them?
No.
Or is this part of them?
No, it's just, that's the thing, we talked about this before. You got to think of, in many ways, these transporter angels are very different. They're, in many ways, like what we think of as a machine being, with shuttle bay doors, and things like this. I mean, these angels are a fancy machine. They're not like the other angels, okay? And they've got this part of their body are these friction shields. Your guardian seraphim don't have friction shields, is that right? Okay, but transporter angels have it's part of their body. And they literally have to, other people have to work with them like a machine. They put the person in there and then they've got to make sure they secure that down. It's like, okay, just that is okay, it's tightly sealed. I mean, it's like they're working with a device.
They're not self.
But it's a living, personal, conscious device.
So Don and I know this guy. His name is John Bullock, Sandra Bullock's father. And he claims that he had this experience. That's why he's totally into the Ranch Book, because he read about it in here. And he had this
experience. He goes, wait a minute, I know about that,
Of seeing a transport angel being in. After he had a major accident, he was out in the middle.
And he was trapped under a bulldozer.
It's an interesting story. It's just like totally changed his whole life in terms of this kind of thing.
Right, so that, you know, like they said, there's, you know, sometimes, you know, and, you know, there are times I'm pretty sure that why people will have some of these visions like this is there's an opportunity. It's like, well, you know, we could use that. We could kind of seed this person. Let's give them a little something here during this opportune time, and, you know, and they'll carry it forward. But anyway, yeah, so this is why it's not so much that, you know, see that... that Isaiah actually saw that, and, you know, but see, he couldn't see anything else because that was the traditional idea. And, you know, if you read that passage in Isaiah, you know, it literally says that one set was for flying, you know, see, because it's just, there has to be a set for flying. But of course, you know, we know they don't need a set of wings to fly through the air because... Because there's a motion system, right? And they just delocalize and relocalize in that motion system. We talked about that. Yeah. But obviously, poor old Isaiah or all those other people can't think of such fancy physical thoughts. All right.
When celestial beings are to be in seraphim for transfer from one world to another, they are brought to the headquarters of the sphere. And, after due registry, are inducted into the transit sleep. Meantime, the transport seraphim moves into a horizontal position immediately above the universe energy pole of the planet. While the energy shields are wide open, the sleeping personality is skillfully deposited by the officiating seraphic assistants directly on top of the transport angel. Then both the upper and lower pairs of shields are carefully closed and adjusted.
So again, that whole process, very machine-like, and you notice it's, see, the universe energy pole. See, they're just trying to stress. Think of this as like a device. You know, it's an energy device, and it's related to energy circuits and everything. It's
Where would that be, though? How do you know what? Okay, so the universe energy.
So the energy pole. Every planet has an energy pole. You know, we don't know where it is on this planet. You know, because we don't have the typical headquarters. You know, where it would obviously be located. But somewhere on this planet is the energy pole. If we are connected to the circuits, that's, you know, where the circuits would, you know, come down and engage the planet. But all of the non-communication circuits that we're still connected to are anchored at that point. You know, that's the effective planetary headquarters point, wherever that is. And, you know, every world has to have that. Yeah, it's just one point.
It's gonna be a busy point.
Yeah. Yeah, all this stuff happens. You know, we talked about this before. You think about, you know, a big architectural world, you know, with that energy pole, and, you know, there's just, you know, countless angels coming and going. I mean, this is all happening in an incredible, you know, process where they're doing all this fancy stuff in some really rapid way and boom, 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 firing them off. Okay. You know, it all sounds like some floaty, lofty sort of a thing, but it's got to be some very fast precision thing going on, okay, if you actually saw it. Okay.
And now, under the influence of the transformers and the transmitters, a strange metamorphosis begins as the seraphim is made ready to swing into the energy circuits of the universe circuits, energy currents of the universe circuits. To outward appearance, the seraphim grows pointed at both extremities and becomes so enshrouded in a queer light of amber hue that very soon it is impossible to distinguish the enseraphimed personality. When all is in readiness for departure, the chief of the transport makes the proper inspection of the cargo of life.
No, the carriage of life.
Carriage of life. Boy, I'm seeing what I want to see. Subjectively.
You said you were tired.
That's okay. Just keep
carries working. Out the routine tests to ascertain whether or not the angel is properly encircuited, and then announces that the traveler is properly enseraphimed, that the energies are adjusted, that the angel is insulated, and that everything is in readiness for the departing flash.
Mechanical control.
Let's just stop there and ingest that a little bit, because there's a lot of stuff. Okay. All right, so energy, you know, we remember how we read about energy transformers and energy transmitters, and we talked about this briefly back then. There's an energy transformer. Remember, they're the personal one. The transmitters are, you know, machine-like, you know, not personal. Energy transformer is the chief of transport there. Okay, so that personality is doing all of that inspection of the carriage of life, etc. There. Okay, so that's what's going on there. It's all some very complicated process, and you've got this one, you know, all the machines are doing their stuff, but there's a person that's overseeing it, making sure everything is done just so by the machines. Okay?
The mechanical controllers.
More machines.
Two of them. Next, take their positions. By this time, the transport seraphim has become an almost transparent, vibrating, torpedo-shaped outline of glistening luminosity. Now the transport dispatcher of the realm summons the auxiliary batteries of the living energy transmitters, usually 1,000 in number, as he announces the destination of the transport. He reaches out and touches the near point of the seraphic carriage, which shoots forward with lightning-like speed, leaving a trail of celestial luminosity as far as the planetary atmospheric investment extends. In less than 10 minutes, the marvelous spectacle will be lost even to reinforced seraphic vision.
Okay, two little things there. Okay, this extended description here, they've been describing this thing steadily delocalizing. You can see that, so that finally, you know, it's almost transparent. You know, as we were saying, there's very little that's actually sort of down in finite space, and hence can be seen. It's mostly transcendent, you know, and hence, you know, so that's what this process is describing. This whole, you know, queer light of an amber hue and stuff. I mean, it's the physics of this process of this thing delocalizing. You know, and to a large degree, and then tearing off as that energy transformer touches it. And you've got all of these, like I said, the mechanical controllers, all the energy transmitters, all these living machines doing all these mysterious things. And then the other thing is, in less than 10 minutes, the marvelous spectacle will be lost even to the reinforced seraphic vision. Most likely, the reason why they're telling you that detail in less than 10 minutes, they're giving you some food for speculation. Most likely, they can see it until it gets outside of the cocoon that surrounds our solar system that's established by the mechanical controllers. We've talked about that before. You know, when they called it, and they designated that cocoon Monmasha, it's when the mechanical controllers came and they set up this bubble, you know, that isolates us from the high energies outside of that bubble. So I would guess that that's probably what they're giving you here is, you know, I don't know how long it takes them to get up to three times the speed of light, you know, but you think about, you know, it takes a little over 8 minutes for light to travel from the sun to here. See, that's a solar system sized number of 10 minutes. So most likely, even reinforced seraphic vision can see it until it goes outside of that cocoon of the master physical controllers and goes out into the, you know, out in the outer extra solar system environment. That's probably indirectly giving you a way of playing with the idea of how big that cocoon is. See, where how much distance it is to that boundary.
But this delocalizing isn't making it less real.
No, I mean,
otherwise there'd be no point of all of this.
It's just, doesn't have much footprint down in the finite. It's mostly in the absentite,
Yeah, they can't transport physical.
Right.
It's
simple. Yeah, so anyway, so that's...
It just seems like it takes a little bit longer.
That's the amazing thing, to try to figure out what's the contrast between how, as long as it's, you think it would have to take, and some sort of a boom, 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 boom sort of thing.
Especially if they're getting it right,
There's a tension here in various places in the book between this elaborate description, and then it's like,
maybe they're getting set up.
And you think, well, can they do it like a whole bunch of them side by side or something? Well, maybe. The thing that's hard to understand is, about moves into a horizontal position immediately above the universe energy pole. Well, okay. That would be problematic if the energy pole is like the size of my finger. Kevin, I don't know, maybe the energy pole is pretty big, and so you can have a number of them immediately above. I don't know.
It could be 3 square miles.
But I wanted to kind of create this tension in your mind between a apparently pretty elaborate process and then other descriptions where it's a rapid fire thing that's going on. It's like, well, how do I resolve that? I don't know.
Yeah, you don't want to screw up if you're in the
traffic. Right. Yeah, so, anyway.
Get it secured. Don't have to abort it. Okay.
Then there's.
While planetary space reports are received at noon at the meridian of the designated spiritual headquarters, the transporters are dispatched from this same place at midnight. That is the most favorable time for departure and is the standard hour when not otherwise specified.
Yeah, so like for instance the archangel thing, it's connected to this pole, and so at noon you'll receive inputs in the archangel circuit, but at midnight you'll launch from here. Why would you launch at midnight? Why is that logical?
Sun's gravity.
For that is the most favorable time. If I launch at midnight from that point, the sun is in the opposite direction, so that I don't launch him through the sun. It'd be handy to not, right? Okay, that's
a focalizing agent.
That's the reason, right? That's just the reason. You're doing it, anti-direction to the sun. Like we said, because that's going to impact them if they try to go through too many material objects like the sun. Okay, and then just the one other thing: when we get, if you're on an architectural world, that's the same fact is the case. But on an architectural sphere, you will have a broadcast station, not just a receiving station. The broadcast is the opposite pole, so you receive at this at this point, you broadcast at the opposite side of the world.
Yeah. Midnight, what time zone?
The time zone of the pole. I mean, there's only one spot on the Earth. They say noon at the meridian, the local meridian, right?
Not midnight at the oasis.
Okay, all right. Let's keep going here. We're running out of time, guys.
Six. The recorders. These are the custodians of the major affairs of the planet as it functions as a part of the system and as it is related to and concerned in the universe government. They function in the recording of planetary affairs but are not concerned with matters of individual life and existence.
Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. We got recorders at this level again. Subcategory six is, as always, is the recorders. Just reminding you that they're not involved with the individual thing. That's the guardian angels are doing the recording about individual life and existence. So this is just all of the planetary affairs that they're dealing with. So, okay, so that's all pretty obvious.
Seven, the reserves. The Satania Reserve Corps of the Planetary Seraphim is maintained on Jerison in close association with the reserves of the material suns. These abundant reserves repletely provide for every phase of the manifold activities of this seraphic order. These angels are also the personal message bearers of the local systems. They serve transition mortals, angels, and the material suns as well as others domiciled on the system headquarters. While Urantia is, at present, outside the spiritual circuits of Satania and Nerlaishadek, you are otherwise in intimate touch with interplanetary affairs, for these messengers from Jerusalem frequently come to this world as to all the other spheres of the system.
So there is the answer, most likely answer to your question about how do, would those... those songs of glory about the potential on this planet have gotten to other worlds. You've got all of these reserves serving as personal messengers, and you know whether or not a world is cut off from the circuits or not. There's all kinds of messages that are constantly being carried back and forth, as they're saying there, by these individuals. And we saw that before, how the reserves serve as these messengers. So that's
these guys. Travel inside transport seraphim.
Yeah, yeah, they travel inside transport seraphim. Yes, right.
Took a while for that message to get there. Right?
Yeah, so I mean,
they're on the get to some place that has a reflectivity, and then it can get there.
But the very fact that it said heralded to the worlds back there when you read that. See, and here they point out that they come to this world as to all the other spheres of the system. So this would be a very natural way for that to be spread from world to world is via these seraphim.
You think because it was Michael, it would be heralded to every world in heaven.
Yep. Yeah, and like you said, I mean, once it can get up into the circuits, right, then it can go to the whole local universe easily. But obviously there's a lot of cut off, worlds that are cut off from the circuits in our local system, and so it would have gotten to them via these angels. All right, so there we go. We have a little bit more, just kind of wrapping up the other two groups of seraphim next time, and then we move into closing out this paper with some stuff about seraphic destiny. So we'll get into that next time here. Let's take a moment.